So the first thing I want to do today is kind of finish the argument we introduced last time about why this formula for the Wilson line really tells you about scattering amplitudes for 4D gauge theory. Then I want to move on to discuss how to discuss interacting theories of gravity on twister space. So if you remember, we have this formula. I'll write it out very quickly. For instance, for a gauge invariant defect or operator on twister space, and it was given by something like the following. So we have sum and I wanted to say that this formula that this reproduces scattering in 4D self-dual Young Mills in the presence of the operator to raise p squared. So remember, a priori, this scattering process is going to be some kind of complicated thing with Feynman diagrams. And we want to see that on twister space, this formula, you know, we're lifting that operator to twister space. And the point is that once you've lifted that operator to a gauge invariant thing on twister space, you really don't have to do anything else. So here's the proof. We lift states on OR4 to twister space. So we discussed this last time. If we have a state, a massless state, with momentum described in terms of two spinners, the alpha dot. Where lambda, I'm assuming, is 1 z naught. OK, so the information of the spinner lambda is where I put it on twister space. And the information of the other spinner is encoded in this plane wave on twister space. And we note if lambda I is 1 ZI, then this IJ, the angle bracket IJ from the spin helicity notation, which is epsilon alpha beta lambda I alpha lambda J beta, is going to be equal to, well, there's some choice of signs, but with this choice of signs, zj minus zi. So that's good, because in our formula, we had the difference zi minus zj, whereas in the Park-Taylor formula, we had these angle brackets, and they're going to correspond to each other. Step two, we note that on twister space, the states are localized on the codimension 1, there's a codimension 2 loci, where z takes a fixed value. So we draw a picture. I have a bunch of points. And over each point, I have a plane wave. So the states don't interact. So the point is the action functional in twister space is local. So if I have states which don't touch, and you put them into the action functional, you get 0 because it's a local action functional. So they don't interact or scatter, except off the holomorphic Wilson line. So most of the time in twister space, they just fly past each other, but this holomorphic Wilson line wraps a whole copy of CP1, and they all bounce off it. Or they just hit it and interact with that thing. So they only interact with each other through their interactions with this defect.
I'm sorry, can you explain
system? Explain?
Like,
why they don't interact? OK, so are you happy with the fact that when I write them on twister space, I find field configurations? You know, this one is 0. So if you take this one, it's 0 except on this plane, on this complex surface. And this one is 0 except on a different region.
Because it is a wave plane?
Yeah, because it has a delta function in it, and those delta functions are in different values of z.
Okay.
So there's no point on twister space where two of these fields are non-zero. Now, the interaction is local on twister space, so it just involves multiplying those fields, and at least one of them is 0, so you get to get 0.
Oh, why are we calling these lines holomorphic Wilson lines? I don't see how they are Wilson lines.
It's just by analogy with the formula for the path ordered exponential, that's all.
Okay.
I mean, you should think the 1 over zi minus zj looks like delta function ti is less than tj. In that case, step 3. So on twister space, the scattering is computed by simply inserting R wave functions into the holomorphic Wilson line. So, for example, here I take this expression. This expression, has n external fields and we take them to be to be the n massless particles we're scattering. So that the first b, b is going to be like a delta function where z takes some value. So I'm making the mistake I made last time of using the symbol zi for two different things. So let me correct the notation. We call this w. So the first bi, b of w1, could be delta function where w1 is z1, e times the plane wave. And similarly, a of w2 might be the delta function w2 is z2 times e to the plane wave. And so on. And if we do that, then the amplitude we're computing involves simply replacing C wi minus wj by ij. And we get is this making sense? Like, the reason is we don't, like, once we've inserted these delta functions, this is going to be an integral over these w's. Once we've inserted these delta functions, we no longer have to integrate. Right? Integrate just involves evaluating. Yeah?
Last time we introduced these deltas in the exponential, saying that when we go back to real space, we get plane wave?
Yes.
How do we know that it's associated to the curly B and the curly A?
So on space-time, I'm scattering n plane waves, two of negative velocity and two of positive velocity. So these are going to be the external fields in the process I want to compute in twister space too. So there is an issue I'm kind of sliding over in that you really have to sum over permutations, because your positive velocity state involving the delta function and zi could actually end up being any one of these guys. So really, we have to sum over permutations. Was that your concern?
I think I just don't see exactly what the fields are physically. Like, in the real space, e to the ipx would be for, like, f for a. But is there a one-to-one correspondence where the curly a corresponds to the a in real space?
And yes.
Okay.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, so this corresponds to, if I was to do this in real space, I had my operator trace b squared, and then I had some kind of complicated Feynman diagrams of some kind. Maybe there might be plus minus, plus, plus, plus minus, or something like that. Then I'd have straight b's and straight a's. And these straight a's, these are going to be plane waves. And then they correspond to the curly a's on twister space. So I would go, you look at this diagram. It has two negative, a bunch of positive. And there's also an ordering on them given by the trace ordering, because I've drawn it as a planar diagram. And then you just say, this, the very first one, corresponds to this very first one. Is that clarify? Yeah. Okay, is everybody happy with this? I find it, I don't know. This is kind of miraculous that it works, right?
Can I ask, maybe this was discussed before, but is there a reason why they alternate?
Oh, I didn't. I've been writing it more sloppy than I did at the beginning, because so they don't alternate. There's a B in the middle. There's two B's, because I have two negative velocity states. The two B's are at some point, and between the two B's, there's a bunch of A's.
Yesterday, when we wrote for the first time the delta function, we also wrote like factors of DC and DC bar so that it transformed.
Yes.
We wanted to write a scalar field, but
yes.
Here these two, like both correspond to photons or gluons.
Yes.
Okay. But negative and positive.
Yes. So you're right. I'm the way I'm thinking about it. So I didn't write it all out. So the way I'm thinking about it is, anytime you have one of these delta functions, you really think of implicitly there's a dz bar there, a dw bar. So delta function w equals z is really like d bar 1 over w minus z. So this has a dz or dw bar in it. And I didn't write the powers of dz. They kind of clutter up the notation a little bit. But you know, it's just going to be dz to whatever the relevant power is, and you don't worry about it too much.
Okay, so could you repeat when we do this integral after, like, I want to put insert all the delta functions, and what are the, like, all the integrals are over CP1? Or?
Exactly, so these are in CP1. So I insert, this is a delta function where w is z1, this is a delta function where w is z2, and so on. And then when I'm integrating a delta function, so it doesn't really matter. I'm just stop the integrals. But so the CP1 is the set where the v alpha dot equals 0. It's the CP1 at the origin. So on the CP1 that we're integrating over, e to the lambda tilde alpha dot v beta dot, these exponents becomes 1, because it is the CP1 at the origin. And that's why those drop out too. So you might wonder, like, how would I find something with angle brackets? So if our Wilson line, holomorphic Wilson line, had things like d by dv alpha dot a beta, things like this, in it, then we would find angle brackets, or sorry, square brackets. Okay. So I hope this is reasonably understandable, and here's an kind of exercise in this vein. Compute the scattering in self-Julian Mills at tree level. Of the operator, which is like the next one you would see, trace B cubed, beta 3, epsilon, 1, alpha 2, epsilon. So this is just a, it's the same, everything is in the same vein, except I have a more complicated operator, and you might want to compute the scattering of 3 negative helicity and n minus 3 positive helicity. And as a hint, the twister lift of this starts as integral right, because we're scattering off an operator inserted at the origin in space-time. So that means that operator at the origin in space-time becomes a particular CP1. So like the origin is this CP1. So what we're computing is it's called a form factor when I scatter off an operator.
But let's say it's at z equals 0, and the V's are linear combinations of the Z's and Z bars.
V's are linear combinations of U and U bar.
U and U bar.
With these are coordinates in space-time, yes.
Oh, so we're just choosing that. We're just choosing to put it at zero.
Okay. Exactly, yeah. I mean, if you put it somewhere else, you would find the same answer shifted by some simple expression.
I thought this trace of B squared was a null Lagrangian as a function of X.
Yes, so the thing that's most natural to compute from twister space is like if I have this thing in the Lagrangian, I can first see what happens if I put it at the origin and then integrate over its position. So the thing that's really natural in twister space is the first stuff, like what happens if I put it at the origin. So I hope you can see that, doing this is actually not hard using the techniques we have. You just have to turn it into, figure out the rest of the terms that make it gauge invariant, and that's the answer. But it's something that like people wrote papers about in the mid-2000s, and I learned last week that this expression appears in interactions between gluons and the Higgs in QCD, so it's not completely pointless. Okay, so
basically, what is this operator? Because, like in Young Mills, we know that there's a vertex with three gluons,
mm-hmm.
but you have a derivative.
Like, I don't see why this has dimension 4.
It doesn't. It has dimension 6. So it's not a term in the Lagrangian of Yang-Mills theory. The way it arises is in the following way. And I'm just kind of copying what Lance Dixon explained in his talk a week or two ago, if you were there. But so basically, this is the Higgs. And you integrate out the top quark. You integrate out the top quark and you get some effective vertex. And the effective vertex looks, one of the terms is trace B cubed times the Higgs. So the thing we're computing would have some relevance to this kind of process. But I don't actually know really any of this stuff. I'm just kind of parroting what Lance said. Okay. If people are reasonably happy with this picture, I wanted to move on to discuss gravity for a little bit. Okay, so. So a good reference for what I want to explain today is Roland's most recent archive paper. Who explains at the beginning Penrose's construction of self-dual solutions of the self-dual Einstein equations. So we saw that if I have a field G, so H, O2, O-6, then we can have the Lagrangian integral G d bar H. Remember, the key point is that these numbers have to sum to 4. And solutions of the equations of motion mod gauge R H will give a solution of the linearized Einstein equation. With C minus equals 0, where C is the veil tensor. And G will be the same with C plus equals 0. So this is just kind of parallels what we had for a free Yang-Mills theory, where I had B and A. And A parameterized gauge fields with F minus equals 0, and B those with F plus equals 0, but all at the linearized level. So we have the following question. Can we make this interacting so that we see the nonlinear Einstein equations? And the answer is, of course, going to be yes. I'll write down an interacting model. But just like in gauge theory, we didn't see the full Yang-Mills equation in any easy way. The thing that came from twister space was the self-duality equation, which implies the Yang-Mills equation, but it's stronger than it. And similarly for gravity, what we're going to find is not the Einstein equation, but a stronger equation, which is the self-dual Einstein equation. So the interaction, Lagrangian is the following. It's the integral g d bar h plus 1/2 g d by dv alpha dot h d by dv beta dot h times epsilon alpha dot beta dot. So you guys are familiar with this expression here. This is the Poisson bracket. You might wonder why this makes sense. If, because H is the 0-1 form coefficients in O minus 2, it turns out, we discussed this before, its derivative is a 0-1 form coefficients in O1. So differentiating changes the weight. So this expression has weight 1 minus 6, and the sum is again minus 4, which is what we want. So with the following theorem, due to Penrose, those h O2, which satisfy what the equation's in motion, which is d bar h plus 1/2 hh equals 0 up to gauge transformations. Are the same as solutions to the Einstein equation with C minus equals 0. Okay. So okay, any questions about this statement? Oh, and this is Penrose called this nonlinear graviton.
What does it mean physically to have C, like something related to the more intense or equal to zero?
It's a bit of a funny condition, because in Lorentzian signature, the plus and minus parts of the Weyl tensor are not real. They're both imaginary, but they're complex conjugate. So if we were in a Lorentzian signature, and I looked for a real metric satisfying this equation, it would be flat, because both components of the Weyl tensor would vanish, and the Ricci tensor would vanish too by the Einstein equation. So it's really only something that appears in 2,2 or Euclidean signature. Other than that, I'm not sure what to say. It is, there are very interesting metrics which satisfy this equation. There are some metrics which look a little bit like black holes and satisfy this equation.
What do you mean up to gauge transformations?
Yeah, I didn't explain what the gauge transformations are. So we have a gauge prime for chi. So I can look at the Poisson bracket with chi, which is this expression. And this is just a vector field. With no weight. The point is the O2 has been absorbed into the two vectors. So if this is to be a theory of gravity, the hallmark of a theory of gravity is that the gauge transformations are coordinate transformations. And that's what we're going to find here. The gauge transformations on twister space are these coordinate transformations. So the gauge transformations are equal to coordinate transformations by the vector fields so these transformations act in a natural way on all the other fields. Okay, so let's try to understand. We have this kind of great result that the self-dual Einstein equations are described by these fields H on twister space satisfying this equation. So let's try to see if we can understand that equation geometrically. So if I take H then the Poisson bracket with H using the same formula we wrote before is going to be let's write it out again this is a 0-1 form on Twister space with coefficients in the tangent bundle. A tensor like this, 0-1 forms with coefficients in the tangent bundle. This is the space of Beltrami differentials, that's what it's called. So it's a standard result in math, going back to work of Kodaira and Spencer, that if I have a complex manifold and I want to deform it, what you need to do is Beltrami differential is the data you need to deform a complex manifold. So let me say this in general. X is a complex manifold. And take V we can deform X by deforming D bar to D bar plus V. So in coordinates, V looks like V I J D Z bar I D Z J in some patch. And D bar looks like DZ bar I. Looks like that. So I'm adding on to the D bar operator some new term, but now which involves the Z derivatives. So what's the meaning of this? This is a deformation if and only if d bar plus v squared equals 0. Wait. If I want this to be the d bar operator on a new complex structure, you need this equation, because d bar squared is always 0. And it turns out that this is sufficient. And then I figure out my new complex manifold by saying, well, the D bar equation tells me what it is to be holomorphic. It tells me from the D bar operator, I read off the Cauchy-Riemann equations. And what's happening is I'm changing the Cauchy-Riemann equations by adding that term. So the new holomorphic functions satisfy I write, this is a so we get this new equation for what it means to be holomorphic. So I've probably should have put in the epsilon. The epsilon here is inserted to make sure you think that this is a very small deformation. And I've modified the equation like that. I suppose it's not entirely necessary. Let me just write like this, sorry. That's confusing. Okay, this is fine.
This is just deforming the smooth structure of the manifold.
It turns out the smooth structure can't be deformed. It's deforming the what it means to be a holomorphic function. Have you taken a string theory course? So, in string theory, people, the Riemann surfaces of moduli, and you integrate over those moduli. So those moduli are exactly the deformations of the complex structure. In higher dimensions, it's more complicated.
I'm sorry, what's the difference between deformation of the complex structure and the smooth structure?
Well, if I have a complex manifold, you have an extra piece of data which tells you on each patch, these are the holomorphic functions. So the extra piece of data on a complex manifold is the system of Cauchy-Riemann equations. Smooth manifolds are really floppy and don't have any structure on them. They don't really have enough structure that I can deform them continuously. But a complex manifold is a more more rigid object. It's a bit closer to having a metric. And if I have a complex manifold, there is something you can deform, which is the system of Cauchy-Riemann equations.
So the smooth structure is the functions that take us from one patch to another patch.
Yes.
And we also demand that they be holomorphic.
Well, that's data, really. Yeah. If you have a smooth manifold, you know, you have all kinds of different ways of writing it with coordinate patches and all kinds of allowed coordinate transformations between each patch. The data of a complex manifold is you're cutting out the allowed ones to only those which are holomorphic.
Holomorphic with respect to the deformed?
Yes. Or, you know, really there's two ways of doing it, right? So there's, I'm describing the Dahlbow way, or I'm telling you, on the whole manifold, this is the Cauchy-Riemann equation. And then you say, okay, I choose coordinates compatible with this new Cauchy-Riemann equation. And then I do, from each coordinate, when I go from one patch to another, I get some new holomorphic coordinate changes forced on us by this. But we could also think about the Czech picture, which is how we do things in patches. And there's a Czech Dahlbow isomorphism, which we'll need. Okay. So what we've almost written down is that this equation here from Penrose's nonlinear graviton is exactly the equation which tells me I can build a new complex manifold. So the equation d bar h plus half h equals 0 is equivalent to saying that d bar plus bracketing with h squares to 0 so that d bar plus h defines a new complex manifold. So in this new complex manifold, an object such as a function is holomorphic if d bar f plus hf equals 0. So this is the new Cauchy-Riemann equation. Well, we notice whatever Poisson bracket with h is, the way we define the Poisson bracket, it only points along the v directions. It only has d by dvs. It doesn't have any d by dzs in it. So h Poisson bracket with z is equal to 0. So z is still holomorphic. This means our new manifold called X has a map X to CP1. Okay, so what I'm trying to pin down is, like, pin down, you know, H gives you some new complex manifold, but it's not arbitrary. It has some special features coming from the fact that this vector field is not an arbitrary vector field. It's a Poisson bracket with something. So there are two special features. One of them is it preserves Z, and the other is it preserves the volume form in the V1, V2 plane. So since H is Hamiltonian, well, say it preserves, the volume form. So the final theorem will recast all this entirely in terms of geometry, getting rid of any mention of H. And this form is how it was written originally. So I'll leave the form we wrote up first here, that this is equal to a collection of complex manifolds. So three complex dimensional complex manifolds X with a vibration Z from X to CP1 and on the fibers a volume form which is twisted by O minus 2. So this is equal to the kind of more global form.
Can you repeat the second part?
Yeah, so on the fibers of this map, I want to have a holomorphic volume form. The thing that plays the role of dV1, dV2. So however I patch things together, I must preserve dV1, dV2.
Is it like a connection? Flat connection somewhere?
Is which like a flat connection? H?
Yeah.
It's like that, yes. But you're thinking about this equation, right? Well, the way to think about it, let's look at the general case. I have a 0, 1 form, values in the tangent bundle. So I want to have a new complex manifold. So I want the equation d bar plus v times something to have n solutions locally. I want to be able to find n independent holomorphic functions. Now, the equation that the square of it vanishes, that's necessary. Because if the square didn't vanish, you know, it vanishes whenever the square vanishes whenever I apply it to a solution. You know, if this is holomorphic, this implies V squared f equals 0. And if there are n holomorphic solutions which are independent, that turns out implies that d bar plus v squared on equals 0 on anything. So this is, you know, is also true for flatness. Flatness tells me that I can find lots of solutions to a certain PDE, and it's something similar here. Yeah.
Why do we need a fiberized holomorphic volume form? It looks like you just use the Poisson bracket there. Why did you write like volume form there and not like fiberized Poisson tensor or something?
Well, a fiberized Poisson tensor would just be the inverse of it.
But can it possibly be degenerate?
Well, I see. So in this formulation, we're starting with a Poisson bracket, which is non-degenerate in each fiber,
okay,
and kind of looking at perturbations of that.
Okay.
So you're asking, like, if I want a more global thing, like, do I allow even more degenerate Poisson tensors? And I think the answer is no. If you want to get an actual solution of the Einstein equation, you need this. Yeah.
I think I missed the explanation on the map between the manifold and CP1.
Yeah, so I've changed the Cauchy-Riemann equation to this equation, and I want to ask, because Poisson bracket with H only involves derivatives with respect to V, the condition of being holomorphic doesn't change for a function that only depends on Z. So in my new manifold, Z is a holomorphic function. So I get a map. I get a map from some patch of X to some patch of CP1. And then we just have to think a little bit about what happens. I also have 1 over Z on the other patch. So together, they'll give me a map to all of CP1.
The thing that confuses me is X in our case X in our case is like V and Z.
Yes, exactly, yes.
And the map only cares about the Z.
Exactly, yeah.
How does this map work when we are on a different C2 plane?
When you do this kind of thing, or when you change?
If we're on a different fiber.
Yes.
How do we think of the map? At a specific, if I set V1, V2 to be something, then I just map it to some Z and CP1. If I do it on a different V1, V2, how does the map look?
Oh, well, let's see. Twister space has this patch with its three coordinates, V1, V2, V1, V2, and Z. And all we're using is that Z is a function on that patch, which it clearly is, because it's just one of the coordinates. I mean, the way I always think of Twister space is like it's a CP1, and over that CP1 are fibered a bunch of copies of C2. And what's going on, if I do a small perturbation of the flat geometry, I'm changing the way these copies of C2 are fibered, possibly in some nonlinear way. But it's always just fibered over that CP1. Okay.
So this is a space of the formations of Twister space.
The solutions of the self-dual Einstein equations is the space of deformations of Twister space. And what I'm writing here is trying to say deformations of Twister space, but with some particular structures which are present on Twister space. They survive.
Maybe you explain this, but I don't remember. Can you explain what twisted by all minus 2 means?
Right, so, yeah, I didn't explain that. So if I look at one patch on CP1, I'll have a volume form in the fibers, and the other patch on CP1, I'll also have a volume form in the fibers, but they differ by Z minus 2 on the overlap.
When we say dv1, dv2 is preserved by this Hamiltonian vector field, are we also claiming that dv1, dv2 gives us the symplectic 2 form, and we have a symplectic structure on this space now?
Yes, dv1, dv2 gives us a symplectic structure on the fibers.
for a fixed z.
For a fixed value of z, I get like each fiber of this over CP1 is a holomorphic symplectic. Maybe looking ahead a little bit, you might know that the symmetries of a holomorphic symplectic manifold is W infinity. So here we're seeing that, you know, W infinity has something to do with self two-line sand gravity. So this is part of all this BMS symmetries and celestial orography and so on. Yeah?
I have the same question about the twisted part.
Yeah.
So when we move from one fiber to another one, you said we pick up a factor of 1 over z squared?
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of just the twister space construction, or?
It's because if we started with a flat twister space, and I look at this expression, when I move to the other patch, I pick up a factor of 1 over z squared. So that's just going to be preserved in our new geometry too.
It doesn't have anything to do with the deformation.
No, it's something that was present originally.
And one more question. Can I think of the map as the projection map over there?
Think of which map?
The map that takes me from x to CP1?
Yes.
Just projection?
Yes. It's just. Yeah, and I think, well, there's some technical condition I didn't write down, it's not very important.